two things real quick that I meant to say right off the bat, and I want you thinking about as you move forward from real life. I think everyone, if you haven't experienced these things, you'll be able to identify that kind of inform, for me, you know, why I think moving to a different model will be helpful. This morning, a friend, we get together with some friends who check in with each other, what's going on in their lives, early on Sunday morning. And this fellow lives somewhere in the valley in a little apartment on a beautiful estate vineyard by himself, never locks his door, has been there a while. And recently, in the last couple of weeks, his pickup truck was broken into. They stole his wallet and some sunglasses. And I emphasize those two things because his material loss was frankly trivial. And he very quickly canceled his credit cards and he's ordered a new driver's license. But he's lost his sense of serenity and sense of sanctuary about his home. And he was very moving in how he described it in great detail. And it's not just that he's locking his door where he never did before. As he's driving down the dirt road home, and he's seeing people, if they make eye contact with him and he doesn't know them, he has fear. Is that person know who I am? Are they the ones that broke in? And it's really shattered his world. You can't live as long as I have. I'm 56 years old without having been a victim of some kind of petty crime. And I know, particularly home burglaries, they're terribly invasive. And so I put that out there because one of the questions that I have about our current system is, you know, if those people who stole his wallet get caught, that may be a positive thing, but I'm not sure at all that the catching them and the trying of them and the imprisoning of them will help my friend feel any better. If my neighbor, if their house gets burglarized and they catch the people, I'm not sure I will feel any better about the neighborhood after that sense of place has been destroyed. The other real life case, similar to what you described, involves a family divorce situation that eventually found its way to a restorative justice resolution. And I'm going to save that bit for the end, but just to set it up so you can be thinking about it. I mean, can any of you imagine the following circumstances? There's a divorce. Dad is living by himself, and mom and teenage daughter are living separately. And surprise, surprise, occasionally teenage daughter and mother don't see eye to eye on things. And occasionally there's tension. And one day, the daughter has some kind of an important appointment that mom has to drive her to. And mom has her own appointments and job to get to and is hollering at daughter to get out of bed and get in the car, and no response. And mom goes into the bedroom, and you know, there's a TV going, and there's an iPod plugged into the head, and there's probably texting going on. And so mom tries to break through that, and it escalates very quickly, and to yelling, to mom grabbing teenage daughter by the arm and saying, come on, let's go, and then daughter kicking mom, you know, while still lying in bed. And mom is now very angry, and so she leaves the room and goes and calls dad and says, she just kicked me. And dad, probably very well-intentionedly, said, she needs to learn the consequence of her actions, call the police. So the police are called, the police come, at which point everyone starts to realize that this has gotten way out of hand. And, you know, April Fool, thanks for coming, but we're going to take care of this. And they suddenly discovered that by making that call to the police, they'd lost control of their lives. And there was going to be unintended consequences. And there was a criminal action. And there were social workers. And there was interviews of parents and accusations of questions about whether there was a pattern of abuse. And that is an example of once the system gets engaged, we don't know where it's going to go, and even though it's set up to prevent harm and to help people who are in terrible situations, it often works in very different ways. So I'm going to leave you thinking about that and very similar to what you described, and we'll find out later how it turned out, because there was an avenue, this is up in Seattle, Washington, for something different to happen. I'm going to go back to mediation just for a minute, because first of all, because of the question somebody asked me last week, I want to emphasize that the mediator is a facilitator. Somebody asked me last week if I did arbitrations. They thought, but when they heard mediation, I said, no, arbitration is just like having a judge or a jury. It's just it's a private one. You're turning over a decision to somebody else. In mediation, the parties are in control, and the mediator is someone to help with the process. And this idea that the mediator helps everyone find their voice, helps other people to listen, and what happens really like magic, and I've been through a lot of them, is something shifts if you stick to that process. There is a shifting that occurs, and everyone gets transformed. And everyone may not be happy with the results they get agreed to, but everyone is transformed, and they get to move on with their lives. And mediation is in primarily the non-criminal area. And restorative justice is not mediation. It uses mediation techniques in the criminal arena, but there's an overlap there. I don't know whether I'll be able to fulfill my promise or not, but my goal was to provoke you all a little bit. I told Mother Melania that I would try to come up with a provocative statement that would create some real animated crosstalk, get some people engaged. And then it occurred to me that I've been running the statement by people and no one's disagreed with me yet. So there's a problem there. But our adversarial system, our much vaunted and with our American hubris, you know, we've always got the best of everything and the original. And pardon that little needling digression, but our adversarial system, which has served us for a long time very well, it just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't illuminate truth. It doesn't remedy harm. I would argue it's become dishonest. It's become exclusionary. And what do I mean by exclusionary? It costs $50,000 minimum to bring a case to trial in Napa Valley on a civil matter. Very few people can afford that. Even small companies can't afford that. And once you get there, you don't know what's going to happen. As these distortions to the system have occurred, I would argue that it's become a morally bankrupt system. Because the consequences that are accruing, like you described, Mother Melania, so well, where a whole bunch of the people in jail maybe shouldn't have been there. And on the civil side, there is injury, there's property rights that are violated, people think they're going to get justice, meaning they expect to be made whole and that their side is going to be acknowledged. Rarely happens. It rarely happens. And so, I would add to that that many of us professionals in the system, many commentators, historians, journalists, people in the religious communities, feel that our justice system not only is not doing what it used to do so well, which is help identify what really happened and then address the harm, it's actually dividing us, and it's deepening wounds instead of healing them. And recent example, and every year there's two or three of these, but this situation down in Florida that came to a conclusion a couple months ago, the Zimmerman case, where there was this, for those that don't know, and I imagine any of you who have a television or look at a newspaper know what I'm talking about, but a young man shot another man. The argument was whether he was defending himself. There was a racial element. You had a Hispanic man, and I think he was Hispanic, even though his last name is Zimmerman. And a black youth, and then there's a law in the state of Florida called the Stand Your Ground Law that empowers people to stand their ground and fight back rather than retreat from adversarial situations. And I can't help myself, I promise you I wouldn't digress. But it was the law in this country and before that in England for 1,000 years. The law encouraged people to run away from harm rather than fight. Okay? That's a long honored tradition in the law. And these new laws that are cropping up in places which are actually encouraging people who want to get in fights to do so, just settle that in its head. It's very troubling to me. So this case, this human tragedy occurs where, you know, two young people, and one's dead, and he has a mom, and I don't remember whether the father is in the picture or not, and then another young man that I've heard a lot of good things about, but you know, he shot someone dead after inserting himself into a situation and an altercation ensued. And the immediacy of that, the parties that were involved, it just all got lost in this national shouting match that we see on about a lot of issues. This dualistic, polarizing debate. The people are yelling, and they're over the top, and there was a result in a trial, and you know, the president came out and had, in an informal way, had some very, very profound and moving things to say about what it's like to be a young black man in this country. And all those are valid things. I don't like the stand your ground laws, but I know the people that passed them have some valid ideas animating the legislation. But none of that was relevant to the circumstances of that case. And the real harm, someone lost their life, a family lost a son and a sibling. And you know, Mr. Zimmerman, I have to believe, has some underlying issues that drove him to put himself in that situation. And what about those? And do those issues, are they something that we should be concerned about as a community? And so our model, which is adversarial, isn't addressing those things anymore. Here's a definition of our system from this book, which anyone who's interested in it, see me afterwards. It's called The Little Book of Restorative Justice. It's written by one of the preeminent scholars in the field, a man named Howard Zehr, if I'm pronouncing it right, Z-E-H-R. And this is from this book. Our legal system is an adversarial process conducted by professionals who stand in for the offender and the state, refereed by a judge. Outcomes are imposed by an authority, whether it be the law itself or judges or juries, who stand outside the essential conflict. Victims, community members, even offenders rarely participate in this process in any substantial way. And that statement has the criminal process in mind, but it's every bit as true about civil litigation too. The lawyers don't want their clients to talk. Cases are truly about using. I cringe sometimes as a lawyer when I hear people toss out the word technicalities, but tactics are used to prevent the truth from being fully exposed rather than encouraging full disclosure of the truth. And I think that's a problem. It's gotten to a point that it's a serious problem.
Could you give us an example?
Sure. We all know what the Miranda rights are because we've been seeing it on television our entire lives. The idea that if a law or a constitutional element is violated while evidence is being seized, that the evidence itself will be suppressed. So in that occurrence, which became embedded in our law in the early 1960s, was born of terrible injustices in the South, and a terrible set of wrongs, and racial clashing, and the courts were the only ones who were stepping up try to address that situation. The problem is that everywhere else in the world, the truth stands on its own. And if it turns out that a piece of evidence in Germany, for example, if a piece of incriminating evidence was obtained illegally or through the abuse by a police officer, no, the evidence comes into the court and the police officer is ordered to jail by the judge totally different system. There are consequences from behaving badly. And there are systems in place to discourage it.
Kind of like Hammurabi.
But the truth, you know, the truth comes out. The truth should come out. So here, there's a whole evidence code, and there's a lot of things that, you know, the idea is we don't want, there's some things that appear to be evidence that can be overly prejudicial, and they're really not that probative is the word. And so we don't want that stuff to come in and confuse a jury. And as I hear myself say that, I hear the arrogance of the law. You know, there used to be a time where we trusted juries to get things right. Now, partly animated by our distrust of that. But overall, just because we just want to win, and we don't really care too much about what's really going on. Now, this is my personal opinion. This is my opinion as an observer of the system. It's so much of our national debate is about being right or wrong about whatever, regardless of the subject is, not really finding understanding. I want to seek to understand. And I believe that if we get all the parties around the table in a dispute, and we give everyone a chance to be heard, and we seek to understand each other, that something very different happens, and we move more efficiently in on a truer course towards a kind of justice that you define in terms of wholeness.
We've got juries that are highly prejudiced, and you're just looking for an excuse to make them vote the way they feel, which may be the way you want to go. And then you get juries, for example, the same people, they're upper middle class white people, haven't got nothing else to do. You know what I mean? And they're put on juries, you know, and they have their own political agendas, and you can damn well be sure that you know how they're going to vote. You know,
Mother Melania, we did it. We've got a conversation going. Thank you.
That's why I was happy John was coming.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, I read this famous, I got a book at home, not that thick, of all the cases, orations by Clarence Darrow. I mean, 70 pages of an oration in front of a jury. My God, nobody go through that. Famous essay by him on how to pick a jury. Oh, it's hilarious, actually. And he goes to the various types of people, the Presbyterians, the this, the that, and he goes through one, each one in great detail. And he gets to the Irish. Oh, he says, anybody that would throw an Irishman off a jury should be disbarred. I mean, it is, and I was involved in a case where the jury went against me. They didn't like me, and I don't blame them. I was a smart ass, but the point is this, I was right.
You're absolutely right, yes. And which is why I tell people that come see me who want to go to court, no, you don't, I say. Stay away from court. And by the way, people who come to our offices and really just want to fight and hit back, we send them elsewhere. We say if you're looking for a solution, if you want to bring an end to the agony of litigation, if you want to get on with your life, we're real good at problem solving and helping. But don't go to court because it's nothing like you think it's going to be.
And 32 years ago, I was in Greece, not that young a guy, and I had to go to take care. And this little guy, not much taller than Mother Tabitha, and a handful of sheep, you know. And he wants a conversation, where are you from, this and that. And he says, you know, what's going on in your life? You know, I said, well, I said, I got a legal case going. When I go back, it's been dragging me down. He says, you know, this guy never been in a courtroom. And if he was in one, it wasn't much fancier than the coffee shop that he would go to. And he says, it is better, he says, with your advocate, you know, uneducated shepherd. He says, it is better with your adversary to make a bad deal rather than go to court and make a good one. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
This is art. Read out of the Bible.